We are a few days away from a very important event. And this event doesn't exist in a vacuum. If we go back 100 years to Eastern Europe, you could meet a man by the name of Rabbi Rinus. Rabbi Rinus was the founder of the Mizrahi movement, of the Mizrahi party, of the religious Zionist entity. And at that time, the time that my grandfather grew up in Austropolia, in Russia, it was very common for there to be anti-Jewish pogroms. This was a common phenomenon, as we know. And Rabbi Rinus was somebody who was very connected to the Jewish community and to Jews throughout the world. And when he would hear of these events, you know, over a century ago, the famous pogrom in Kyiv and other places, many, many pogroms, he would gather his family around the table, and this is described in an important work by Rav Meir Bar Ilan, that he would gather his family around the table, and he was visibly shaken. He was disturbed, and he would tell them that we have to act, that we have to do something. And so this takes different expressions, of course. So one thing that we have to do when we're facing a crisis like we are now in Israel is we have to pray, we have to daven, we have to ask God, who's in charge of everything from beginning to end, to help. But there are other things. There are other things. Yes, Tehillim, exactly. Recitation of Psalms. Tehillim, of course. And then there are other things that we could do practically, whether it's sending material goods, or acts of chesed, or kindness, or mitzvahs, or Shabbos candles, tons and tons and tons of things. But there is something that maybe, from a spiritual standpoint, we wouldn't have initially thought of, but is quite significant. And that's the moment that we are approaching right now. My teacher, my Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schachter Shlita, Rabbi Schachter is in his early 80s, and he recently remarked that when he was younger, as a student, whenever there was a crisis in Israel, when there was a war, the students, the yeshiva students, the rabbinical students, they would go to a rally. They would attend a rally, said, whether it was in Washington or at the United Nations in New York or other places, to make their voices heard. And this is something, this is an opportunity that we have right now as we prepare as a Jewish community for a massive rally, which is upcoming, Habalina Latova, please God, a week from Tuesday. The last time we had such a rally was in April of 2002. I'm holding a document, which I'm not going to pass around because it's in Hebrew and it's very difficult to read because it's handwritten. But I Xeroxed a copy of a letter. This letter was written by the dean of the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, Rabbi Zvulun Charlap. He's a very important rabbinic personality. He's still living in New Jersey, although Hashem should have Rachmanis on him and his wholeness. And he writes a letter to his fellow leaders of the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, about the fact that the Jewish community is going to gather Be'ir HaBira, Washington, B'Yom Sheni HaBa'olinu Latova, in the coming Yom Sheni, which means Monday, Gimel Iyar, on the 3rd of Iyar, to ask from our government, Khan, Min Hanasi, Bush, the Congress members, that they should support B'chol Mida, B'chol Yacholtam, Ba'aretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Asa Tamid, Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba, Mereshi Sashana V'yarach Rishana, to stand up and support Israel. Be'is Sara Uvetzuka Shehi Rachman Litzlan Nimtzeis Achshav Hashem Yirachim. At that time, in January of 2002, I was privileged to participate in a student mission to Israel. I was a YU Reed student at that time. It was a very difficult period of terrible terrorist attacks. And so in April, there was this massive rally in Washington. And he asked all of the Rosh Yeshiva, the leaders, the rabbinic luminaries, to join him. And at that rally, there were over 100,000 Jews and friends. We had buses, dozens of buses. I think Yeshiva University sent a total of 50 coach buses from New York that included the high school for boys, the high school for girls, the college, all the undergraduate students, uptown, the men's campus, the women's campus, downtown, and the Reed students. We had lectures, we had shiurim that were given on the buses. There were a group of students, some of the chever who had gone on the trip that I was privileged to be on in January, this student mission to Israel, who organized. We had 5-gallon buckets from Home Depot. Remember like the orange buckets, you know what I'm talking about? So we had 100 of those, and a bunch of the students carried them around, and people were dropping in change because we put on the front of them, some of the guys put on pictures of the victims of terror to raise funds. You know, that afternoon, we got on the bus, we went back to YU. We counted up the money. I didn't count the money, but one of the guys counted the money at one of these Coinstar places. We raised $33,000 in change, the boys and the girls. $33,000 in change one afternoon. So there's actually a student group now in Yeshiva University who's working on putting together another mission. So yesterday I left them, because I have a connection with them, because I was on this past mission. I left the mission. I said, you know, the last time we did this rally, we got buckets from Home Depot. So one of the boys wrote back, who wants to sponsor some buckets? I'm going on Friday to get buckets from Home Depot. I still remember at that rally that Rabbi Seth Mandel, whose son Kobe, Hashem Yikom Damo L'Zechus Yagen Aleinu, his son was murdered, brutally murdered in a cave near Tekoa. He said Shema Yisrael in front of all those people. And I still remember sitting there that day thinking, the Mashiach really needs to come right now. He didn't come for whatever reason, I don't know. But there's something very powerful and important about a rally. And we need to talk about why. Why it's important. And to do that, we can actually look to a model. A model of a rally that took place in the exact same location. In Washington, D.C. At the Capitol. Near the White House. Near the memorials. On the Mall. On Wednesday, October 6th, 1943. We're in 2023. This took place in 1943. Already by the end of November in 1942, the world became aware of the German plans and evidence of the extermination of the policy of killing Jews. There was a guy who worked in a mining company called Geisha. His name was Edward Schult. Hashem should remember him for good. He died years ago. So this German guy was an anti-Nazi, anti-fascist, underground spy. So he worked in this mining company, and this mining company, it's a long story, had ties to a place that we know that they were building that later became famous for the murder of hundreds of thousands, over a million Jews. And there was a man, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro Himmler, who had a meeting when they were planning and constructing and dealing with Auschwitz. So the mining company got wind of this. So this guy, this German guy, whose name was Schult or Schulte, got wind of the fact that the Germans were going to expand their whole, they already had some, these death factories. And he sent word through a different guy, a Swiss Jewish guy, to a man by the name of Gerhard Regner. Gerhard Regner was the World Jewish Congress representative in Geneva. And Regner sent a telegram to the United States, and this cascaded into a major public awareness by November, December of 1942 that the Germans were planning to murder all the Jews of Europe. It was known. I have at home copies of the New York Times. It didn't make front page news, but there was already starting to get some evidence for some of the camps that were operating already long before this point. So people started to become aware of this. So there was a guy, he was born in 1915, his name is Hillel Cook. He was a nephew of Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. So Hillel Cook was a young Zionist activist who moved to, that time it's called Palestine, in 1924, and he's very involved in Zionist activities. He ultimately, at the outbreak of the war, comes to the United States and picks up an alias. His name is Peter Bergson. He calls himself Peter Bergson, and he starts actively recruiting people to help support efforts for European Jews, but being very, very vocal about it. So he creates this thing, this entity called the Emergency Conference to Save the Jewish People of Europe. That's the organization he creates. He has a Broadway show type of thing that's going around talking about what's going on with Jews in Europe, and he's creating a big ruckus. Now, there are many people in the Jewish establishment, and it's not for me to, or anybody to judge them in retrospect, because we're not living at that time, we're not who they were. But they were very uncomfortable with, and they were antagonistic to Peter Bergson, Hillel Cook, who when he later, after the war, went back to being Hillel Cook. And they tried to block his efforts to be very open about what's going on. And why did they try to do that? They're worried about anti-Semitism. We're going to come back to this a little bit later. So this is one track that's happening. So you have Peter Bergson and this group of active lay people, activists trying to get attention. Parallel to that, you have another group. They're called at this point the Vad HaHatzalah, the group for the rescue. Who is the Vad HaHatzalah? The Vad HaHatzalah is a group of Orthodox Jews led by five rabbinic personalities. One of them, I would say, you probably would say, is the most prominent of the rabbinic leaders at that time. His name was Rabbi Eliezer Silver. So Rabbi Eliezer Silver lived in Cincinnati. He was a towering rabbinic figure, extremely active. After the war, he's going to be running around DP camps in Germany trying to help Jews. So he's involved in running this group called the Vad HaHatzalah. Now, the initial Vad HaHatzalah was meant to prioritize the rescue of Jews who were specifically in one slice of the population. Those were rabbis and rabbinical students. That was the initial goal. Because if you remember, at the outbreak of the war, so if you cut Poland in half, so the western part went to the Germans, the eastern part went to the Russians, and Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who was at that time the greatest rabbinic luminary in the world, was living in Vilna, and he told all the yeshiva students they should come to Vilna. So who, it's interesting to think about, there were less than 3,000 yeshiva students in all of the eastern part of Poland and Lithuania and Kovno and Ukraine, all that area, less than 3,000. It's not a huge number. You had to be the creme de la creme, the geniuses, the giants, to be in a yeshiva at that time. Only a few hundred in these different yeshivas. So they go to Vilna and they start communicating with people in America what's going to be. So we've talked about this before. We're not going to go over the whole thing with Sugihara and the visas and Curacao and Japan and the... We'll get it later just because we have a lot. So you remember this whole story. This whole story with how they're going to get... So originally the focus was, wait a second, we only have a limited number of dollars, a limited number of visas, and we want to prioritize, as the Talmud teaches, there's a Mishnah that talks about the prioritization of what happens when you can only save a select few from the many. So we're going to prioritize the yeshiva students who are going to maintain the legacy and the values and the traditions and the guidance for future generations. And they were successful in getting several hundred students out, quite a few rabbis, including Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Rabbi Aaron Cutler is going to, he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Kletsk, which is a small town in Europe. He settles in Lakewood and founds the Beis Medrash Gavoa, which is now an empire of Torah study in New Jersey and around the world. He arrives in America in 1941. He landed in San Francisco before he made his way to New York. This Vad HaHatzalah evolved. It evolved because after the awareness became clear about what was happening in Europe, they became involved in saving as many Jews as they possibly could, which there's a question of, you know, if they would have collaborated with other organizations, it would have been different. But Lamaisa, they were helping Jews, any kind of Jews. And they were partnering with any types of Jewish organizations. So if you want more on the Vad HaHatzalah, which we talked about once in the past, Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, Effi Zuroff, has an entire book on the Vad HaHatzalah. And this I found recently, I did not know about it, so maybe if I retire next week, this would be a good retirement project. Apparently, Irving Bunim, who we'll talk about in a minute, who was, I'll talk about it now. Irving Bunim was one of the most prominent Orthodox lay leaders of the 20th century. He was a philanthropist, but more than that, he was a doer. He was one of the most active people in the Vada Hatzala, later in the Young Israel movement. He was Rav Aaron Cutler's like right-hand man. Rav Aaron Cutler only spoke Yiddish. Irving Bunim spoke Yiddish and English. You should know, could you believe this? Rav Aaron Cutler was like one of the two or three greatest rabbinic luminaries of the period. Irving Bunim spoke at his funeral. A lay leader spoke at Rav Aaron Cutler's funeral, which is like mind-blowing. And he spoke in Yiddish. You can get it online. I have come across it. You can get it online. You can listen to it, and there's a transcription there. So Irving Bunim was like Rav Aaron Cutler's right-hand man. Irving Bunim, I just found out recently, donated the entire archives of his collection, 57 boxes of documents, photographs, and manuscripts of the Vada Hatzala to the YU library. So if I retired next week, in addition to other projects, I would do that. I would go see what's going on there, because they must have amazing things. They must have amazing things in there of the efforts that they made to try to hand for Hatzolah's nefashos. So there were lots of attempts at bribes, getting certain Jews to Switzerland, which they got some. They got a few. They got some, which is more than nothing. By 1943 to 1944, the Vada Hatzala is also starting to step up and be more active in political activism. So they're sending telegrams to different political officials all across the United States. Help us, this is a problem, this is a challenge, this is a tragedy. So in October of 1943, these two groups converge. The Bergson group and the Vada Hatzala, they converge and they say, we need to have a rally in Washington. We need to have a rally of not just anybody, rabbis, leaders. And that was the impetus for this rally that took place in this time of awe, this period of the Yom HaNoraim, which was extraordinary, unbelievable. So if you look on the page that you have in front of you, you have an English page with a partial list of rabbis in pilgrimage to Washington. So if you have it, it's a typed out page. It looks like it was typed in the 1940s. This is exactly what you're looking at, because it was exactly. So you see here a partial list of rabbis who went. We mentioned before Rabbi Charlap, who was the dean of Reitz. His father, Rabbi Yechiel Michel Charlap, was a rabbi in the Bronx for, I think, like 60 years. He was one of the people who attended this rally and spoke on the steps of, I think it was the Capitol, where he was. If you look at the bottom left, if you go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Moses Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was in attendance of this rally. And then, a personal shout-out, if you go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What's that?
It's alphabet.
Yes. If you go up 9, 10 on the right side from the bottom, you see where it says M. Kovalenko? On the bottom right? See where it says M. Kovalenko? That was my great-grandfather.
You also have Abraham
Heschel. Heschel was there, and Rabbi Lazar Silver, and Rabbi Burak, and many, many others. My grandfather, who I knew, I was very close to growing up. He passed away just before my bar mitzvah. His name was Ben Koval, Chaim Baruch. His father, he came with his father as a young man. His father was a rabbi in Europe. They were from Austropolia. His father had an extraordinary life, a whole other story, not for your time today. So he came to America, and my grandfather never went to school because he had to go work. He got fired every Shabbos from his job until he was stocking shelves and cleaning toilets and washing floors for $7 a week, he told me. And that's how he supported his father, who was a Rav, and all of his siblings who came to America after they arrived. So his father was their old name. Their European name was Kovalenko. Then my grandfather, when he became Americanized, changed it to Koval. But someone alerted me to this, and there's actually a photograph. I didn't print it for you because it's very hard to see, but if you go online, you'll see pictures. There's one picture of all of these rabbis. And if you look on the back now, you'll see the New York Times describes over 400 rabbis, all dressed in their full rabbinic garb, marched on Washington, and they presented a letter to Vice President Wallace, pleading, begging, imploring that they save the Jews. Now they showed up to the White House in Washington, and they were hoping, they were begging, they had suggested and offered and inquired if they could see the president. I didn't give this to you, but I have a copy here, and a lot of this is due to the research of an amazing Holocaust researcher who did a lot of work on this topic. His name is Rafi Medoff. So he has a lot of research which was done on the Rabbi's March in Washington as well as other Holocaust topics. So he got a hold of the copy. You know, every day the president, his schedule, they print it for the press. So that day, Wednesday afternoon, he had a meeting with a senator at 12:15 and then his meeting at 12:30. Then he had a lunch at 1 o'clock with the Secretary of State. And then he was available until 4 p.m. But he refused to meet the rabbinic delegation. So here they are in Washington. They don't get to meet FDR, but they make a statement. They make a statement. How much did it impact? It's a good question. There's an interesting article. It's published in Americana, the Journal of American Popular Culture, 1900 to present, called Marching for the Jews of Europe, or The Consequences of the First Jewish Public Relations Campaign in America. It's authored by Diane Sipkin from Pace University in Pleasantville. It's a fascinating article in the fall of 2018, because it's hard to know what the impact of such a rally is. I can't tell you. But she points out that not long after this, there was a very strong push for more involvement of the U.S. government in the issue of Jews in Europe. And I can't say if it's correlated, but as you know, on January 22nd, 1944, FDR signed the executive order creating the WRB, which stands for War Refugee Board. And historians suggest that among the different efforts, if you piece it all together, the War Refugee Board, it's protected around 200,000 Jews during the entire scope of its activities. So I can't tell you with certainty whether that's correlated, but maybe, and that's what this article suggests, potentially. But I'll give you one reflection. I grew up in Baltimore, as you know, and there was a shul in Baltimore. It's still called this. It's called Hertzberg's. Now, it has a real name. I don't know what it is, because everyone just called it Hertzberg's. Why was it called Hertzberg's? Because the rabbi of that shul was a famous Jewish personality and a scholar by the name of Rabbi Dr. Arthur Hertzberg. Famous scholar. So that's why it was called Hertzberg's. He was there for many years. So Rabbi Hertzberg, Zichron Levracha, wrote a letter in 2004 reflecting on that day. I'll read a piece to you. The rabbi's march in Washington in 1943 actually began the Thursday before the date of this demonstration. The leadership of the Agudas HaRabbonim called a fast day. The primary observance was in Baltimore because there was no adequate Orthodox synagogue in Washington in those days and no community of Orthodox families which could house these rabbis for the Sabbath. So everybody came for Shabbos to Baltimore, then they carried on. Dozens of the most notable figures, he writes, who were alumni of the leading yeshivas in Europe took part in the prayers which launched this week long of imploring God and the political leaders to defend and save the Jews under Nazi rule. I was a youngster of 22 who was allowed to be present because the leaders, men who were older than me by a generation or two, were friends and contemporaries of my father, Rabbi Tzvi Elimelech Hertzberg. I saw their tears and heard their sobs. They were standing before God and praying for the life and safety of people who were their brothers and who could have been themselves. I cried among them and I could not stop, not that day, and not for many days to come. On Sunday morning, I was given a seat in one of the cars that drove the 40 miles from Baltimore to Washington. This was a different kind of rabbinic gathering. These rabbis were not clean-shaven or well-dressed. They were avowedly Eastern European. They represented not, quote, American types, quote, from posh synagogues. On the contrary, they might as well have been the rabbis whom Hitler was then putting in death camps along with their congregants. They were standing at the gate of the White House, begging to the president to see them and do something for the Jews who were being slaughtered by the tens of thousands. I could not get up to the fence of the White House, so I had to look on from the park across the road. Eventually, someone came out of the White House. He took a letter from the rabbis to the president, but the president never greeted them. We were soon told that several of his Jewish advisors had told FDR that these immigrant rabbis were not the official leaders of the Jewish community. The people who had put them up to this gesture, such as Peter Bergson and his Emergency Committee to Save the Jews of Europe, were opponents of the Jewish establishment. But this is the postscript. All of us who had been there that day left feeling very bitter. America was our last great hope. If the President of the United States could not take the lead in this effort, or more precisely, if he chose not to be identified with the kind of activist effort that the rabbis were requesting, where could we go now? Was there some other address for our outcry? Or was the outcry being raised at the wrong time? These questions are still being debated to this very day. I continue to feel that the rabbis were right to go on that day in 1943 to the gate of the White House. They were right. Those who advised Franklin D. Roosevelt not to see them continue to bear their shame. Because we need to stand up. So there is a comment of Maimonides, the Rambam. The Rambam Maimonides, in his work, the Yad HaChazaka, the Mishneh Torah, and the Laws of Kings, describes an obligatory war for the Jewish people. And one such war, one obligatory war, one type of war, is what's called Ezras Yisrael Miad Sar Shebo Aleihem, saving Jews from an enemy that comes to attack them. The Rambam says later in the seventh parak, he says, you know, there are certain exemptions from war. Let's say a young married person or somebody just built a home, stuff like that. Maimonides says that doesn't apply when you have a milchemes mitzvah, when you have an obligatory, a war that's mandatory. It's a spiritually necessary mission. So you can't say that I'm not going to fight. Everyone's obligated. Ezra Sisrael Miad Sar. So it was true when Jews were being murdered in 1943, and it's true when Jews are under attack in 2023. I've been very careful the last month not to watch or to read the descriptions of what happened on that day, because I'm afraid of where it's going to put me in the mental space. I'm trying to focus right now on davening, on doing, on organizing, and expressing in different ways. As you see, I haven't shaved since this whole episode, because the not shaving is an expression of mourning. There are families now who are, you can't even say it, who are waiting for their relatives to be buried, but they can't be buried because they can't be identified. They haven't been identified in a month. Because the situation is so horrific that the remains are not being identified yet. A month later, and they're working day and night. Even, Rachmana Litzlan, even dental records are not sufficient for certain things. And there are soldiers, and there are soldiers now who passed away, who were killed in battle. Their families are mourning. So, every one of us, we have an obligation to respond in a milchemes mitzvah, in a war that's an obligatory commandment. And it doesn't matter whether you're an Israeli citizen or you're not an Israeli citizen. If you are commanded by God to observe all of the mitzvot, then you are commanded to observe all of the mitzvot. And it doesn't matter where you live and what your citizenship is. We're all obligated to stand up to Israel, which is under the direct threat of a group of people whose charter is stated that they should annihilate the Jewish state. So it's a milchemes mitzvah. So we have to go out to a milchemes mitzvah. And if that means a person who's trained to be a medic Maybe that person can volunteer. So there's someone from our community who did just that. He's a paramedic. He volunteered. I saw him today. He was invited to go back again. If it means sending monetary support, whichever organization you know is doing good work, that's all part of the Melchemes Mitzvah. In the times of the Gemara, they used to talk about people who fought in the war. They would deliver food. They would hand out sandwiches. So maybe some of us should go. Nebuch, the economy, I'm so worried. First the government has to pay for the war. Then they have to pay for 100,000+ people who are displaced in hotels. Then they have to pay. What about the economy? Business down over 50%. The guy in the back of the shuk with the falafel store. How's it? It's like COVID again, God forbid. So sending funds. But part of this is the inyan of hishtadlus, of trying, like the rabbis did in 1943, of making our voices heard. And this is a unique window that we relate to today, which is different than 1943. You know, Rav Soloveitchik said after the Holocaust, he said, we should clap al chet for not speaking up loudly enough. That's what he said. We didn't live at that time. We're not ones to judge them. We can't judge them, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. We can't judge them. I don't know what it was like to be in 1943. I don't know. You know, there's an expression they would call in Yiddish, a greener. You know, Jews were afraid. They were afraid to look in the mirror. Chaverim Yedita, my friends, this is not 1943. This is 2023. So whatever the establishment, and I'm not going to describe my personal feelings about that, their antipathy to the rabbis who were marching. How dare they be embarrassed of rabbis who look like they came from Europe? It's not right. It's not right. But okay, we're not judging them. It's what it is. But today, if these 400 rabbis had the confidence, the courage to walk in Washington, to stand outside the Lincoln Memorial and pray in public wearing black frocks and hats and bardalach mitpeis. So certainly for us. Because there's an interesting point of contrast. You have a piece of Talmud that you have in front of you, the double-sided page of Gemara. It's a Gemara in Chagiga, in tractate Chagiga. You have the English on the other side for those who want the cheat sheet. The Gemara says in Chagiga. The Gemara says in Chagiga, on Dat Hei Amid Beis, there is a verse. B'mistarim tifke nafshi, God says, in the silent place, in the quiet place, in the secret place, God cries, Mipnei Geva. My Geva, what does it mean that God cries because of Geva? What is God crying about? What does the Gemara say? It's in the underline. You see the underline in the middle of the page. Yes. What? B'mistarim tifke nafshi. What is gava in a bad sense?
Boldness.
Pride. So what does the Gemara say? Read the next line in the Gemara. B'mistarim tifke nafshi mipnei keva. You see where the underline is?
Yeah.
What does the Gemara say? Yeah. There is a place that God has, and it's called the hiddenness. There's a secret place. Go ahead. That's it. If we can understand what this means, think about it in 1943, think about it in today's day and age, what's going on. There is a place that God has where he, so to speak, cries. He cries for the suffering of Jews. And the Gemara goes on to deal with this. How could it be? God is only joy, only light. And you don't deal with this extensively, and we're not going to deal with it today. The Piasetzner spoke about this multiple times in the ghetto in 1941, 1942. What does it mean that God is crying with them? But what is he crying about according to the first opinion of the Gemara? Ga'avasan shel Yisrael, the Jewish pride, shenitla mehem, that was taken away from us and we given to the Goyim, to the Gentiles. God was crying because in 1943, Jews had no pride. We were greener. And this has been the case throughout our history in so many exiles that we had to suffer bizyonis. We had to wear hats. We had to wear stars. We had to wear different colors. We had to suffer bizyonis. The Talmud says God cries for that shame that we have to endure. So what are we looking at today? a fascinating paradigm shift. God gave the Jewish people our homeland, our own state, a sovereign state in our ancestral land. Unbelievable pride. Rabbi Soloveitchik describes that the state of Israel gave Jews around the world pride. You know, he used to commute every week from Boston to New York. Said before the Six-Day War, many Jews, they put their yarmulkes, they put it in their pocket. They were afraid to walk around with the yarmulke. After the Six-Day War, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, people on the train, they were afraid. They weren't afraid. They were happy. They were proud to wear a yarmulke. Because the state of Israel, among the manifold brachos, the innumerable blessings, one of those blessings is the blessing of Jewish pride. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave us Jewish pride. Ga'avos Anshei Yisrael, that now we have some pride. But now, unfortunately, we're suffering. We're suffering. We're being persecuted on college campuses. We're being harassed on social media. But worst of all, of course, we're suffering the indignity and the pain of loss. That our sovereign territory could be invaded by marauders. There's an element of the gaiva of Klal Yisrael, the pride of the state of Israel that has been tarnished. So on the one hand, we're in the state of redemption, where the redemption is the continuum. So we began the redemption. God is bringing Jews back to the land of Israel. It's Kibbutz Golios, the four corners of the earth. People are coming from everywhere. That's already over 100 years. Then he gives us a state and an army, and more Jews are becoming connected to Torah and mitzvos. So there's a process of geula, but there is this expression all of a sudden of darkness, of exile, of pain, of suffering, of loss, the extent of which has not been felt in a single day since Mamish the Shoah. So the same way that the rabbis in 1943 were standing up for the Jewish people, but also for Jewish pride, not to be afraid, not to be cowed, to say that we have to stand up for ourselves. Ga'avos Anshei Yisrael, achas kama v'kama. Certainly today, when God gave us the state of Israel, which is the expression of national pride, that we have to stand up for it. We have to have pride. I'm not saying it's easy. I saw recently in Studio City, California, Rahman al-Islan, a person's home was vandalized by a marauder, an intruder, shouting certain things having to do with, you know, how that person feels about the land that is the eternal ancestral homeland of the Jewish people. So this anti-Jewish, anti-Israel person broke into the house, and the person said afterwards, there were people in the neighborhood, they were afraid. Maybe they need to tick off their mezuzahs. So it's an interesting halachic question, and this already in the times of the Talmud, there were discussions about where you put mezuzahs when you live in a Gentile country, because what do you do if you're worried about danger? So it's a fair question. But it begs the question that we need to ask ourselves, which is, wait a second, are we afraid? And if so, why? Why are we being afraid? Being afraid is associated with exile, with gullus. So maybe, Taka, if we live in America, we should be afraid. It should remind us that this is not our home and Israel is our only place to be. But this is the issue we need to grapple with. That if we believe that we're in the process of Geula and the state of Israel, the gift of God represents pride, Jewish pride, so then we have to be proud. Instead of taking down the mezuzahs, we have to put them up. One of the things that the Kola has been doing the last couple of weeks, among many, is we made lawn signs. What happened to our lawn signs? We stand with Israel?
They were shredded.
Shredded on your lawn. Oh, so a certain person in the community, someone in the community reached out to me with a voice note and said, you know, we see that there are people who are attacking the lawn signs. Maybe we need to take the lawn signs down. Maybe we are, you know, maybe we're getting ourselves in danger. And I said back to that person, I totally hear where you're coming from. But it seems to me, I'm not a political analyst. I didn't speak to the Skokie Police Department. But from my understanding, Jews in 2023, we have a peoplehood, we have a state, we have a place we belong, and we have pride. And if we take down the lawn signs that say we stand with Israel, then we're capitulating to the fear of the Golus. Now, of course, we're in Golus, and this is partly a reminder that we're not in a full station of redemption yet. Because if we were in a full state of redemption, nobody would be able to breach the barriers of our country. Nobody would be attacking our civilians or murdering our soldiers. So we're not totally in redemption yet. But to think that in 2023, we're going to be afraid to put up. So what do? We order 500 more. Because the process of Geula is unfolding, and we have to look toward Israel, the state of Israel, the land of Israel, the people of Israel, as a direction that says there is a future of the Jewish people, a destiny, there's a history that's unfolding. It's not going to be here, it's going to be there, but that we're part of it. And so, to conclude, the importance of going to Washington is both an expression of hishtadlus, of trying, but it's also making a statement of identification, of being proud, of sending support. There is a fellow who I know, a rabbi, his name is Rabbi Doron Peretz. Hashem should give him strength and help. He has two sons, one of whom is injured from fighting, and the other one is missing in Gaza. So he sent a message encouraging, urging American Jews to come out to this rally in Washington. Because we need to make a statement that we stand with our brothers and sisters. We're not hiding in the basement. We need to be out there with them. We need to support them. But ultimately, what did the rabbis do aside from giving the letter to Henry Wallace, aside from meeting with, you know, whoever they could find, even though it wasn't the president? It's like our forefather Jacob. When Jacob prepared to meet Esau, what did he do? First, he prepared for war. So thank God the Israeli military is doing just that, and we're going to support them with whatever we've got, whether that's FIDF or other tzedakahs, things that you can do to help support the soldiers, milchama. The second one is Doron, advocacy. So advocacy is very important. That's part of the reason for this rally, is to show our elected officials that we have a voice. Last weekend, tens of thousands of other people had a different rally. We must show up en masse, and that's Doron. And the last thing is tefillah, is prayer. Rabbi Hertzberg said he saw his father, he saw these rabbis. Before they went, they prayed, but not just that. When they were there, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, they prayed, they davened. So whether we go to Washington or not, that's going to be the last reminder. If you're going to be in Chicago on Tuesday, carve out some time to daven, special davening. Feel that you're part of it. This week's portion, the Torah portion this week, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basada. Isaac goes out to the field to pray. Ultimately, the destiny of the Jewish people is in the hands of God. And we're asking him that through our efforts, we should merit to see the redemption in our day, but to realize that we are following in a tradition, that by having Jews and rabbis take out of their time that they would be studying to go to Washington, this is a mitzvah in a time of Milchemes Mitzvah, and it's an opportunity that we have to create a special Kiddush Hashem.